Good morning, everybody. Can everyone hear me? Excellent. Well, welcome in this beautiful morning, this beautiful Sunday morning in the fall. We're so glad that you could come out and join us. And we're very happy that Reverend Handy could join us. I'll introduce him in a few minutes. Just a little bit of housekeeping. We will have Thais taking pictures later on. That won't end up on Facebook, we promise. That's going to be used for attendance purposes in lieu of passing around the old school attendance sheet that we used to pass around, and then also for contact tracing purposes. So we'll wrap up here around 10:10 and then allow for about 10 minutes of questions. We're going to ask that Reverend Handy repeat the question before he answers it for the people at home, because today's presentation is being recorded. So with that, I'll introduce Reverend Handy. Reverend Chauncey Diego Francisco Handy is a Chicano ordained teaching elder in the PC USA Church. He is currently a PhD student in Old Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. And this morning, he will talk about his Old Testament research that reveals why every one of us is an ethnic reader. He will help us understand how our ethnic backgrounds and diverse heritage shape the ways we read our Bibles. Reverend Handy.
Thank you. If it's all right with you, I'm going to take this off. Is that all right? You all feel safe? If you don't, that's okay. I understand that everyone has a different level of comfort there. Would you all join me in a word of prayer before we get going? Heavenly God, thank you so much for our time together this morning and for the opportunity to think more deeply about how we approach your scriptures and how we understand your presence with us as we read the Bible. Be with us and give us patience and wisdom and words that are worth saying. On my part, anyway, I assume everyone else's. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, so thanks again, Marshall, for the introduction. I really appreciate it. It's a weird thing to suddenly be back in a church and to like chat and have a cup of coffee in my hands. I don't know what's going on, but it's nice. You can just call me Chauncey. Reverend Chauncey is fine if you really feel like it, but Chauncey works. So I'm just going to jump in because we don't have all that much time together. I'll be kind of awkwardly trying to avoid getting in the way of, here we go, better. So now you can see the screen. In case you're wondering, I chose this particular PowerPoint theme to comfort everyone. For those of you who are at home, you can't see it, but there's a cup of coffee behind the words, everyone is an ethnic reader, ethnicity, and Old Testament interpretation. And I did this on purpose because I think that when we enter into conversations around ethnicity or things that are ethnic, a good deal of people kind of start to tense up on the inside. Particularly in our social context at the moment, there's not a whole lot of friendly spaces. Some are very hostile spaces, and some people are used to hostility directed towards them for a variety of reasons. So I want us to start by this, just thinking about a nice cup of coffee on a fall morning. And a nice deep breath of fresh air before we get started. So today I'll be talking about, as you've read and heard, ethnicity and reading the Old Testament. So here's our plan, our roadmap for the day. So we'll be starting by thinking about ethnicity as an idea. Why does it matter? What does it do? Why even mention it at all? And then we'll move on to the way that ethnicity shows up in the Old Testament Hebrew Bible. And particularly in the book of Deuteronomy, which is the focus of my dissertation. So, you know, that's what we'll be talking about there. And then finally, we'll be talking about some implications for what all this means for us as church people here and outside of this place as well. So that said, I wanted to run us through just a couple things. So again, there are possibly uncomfortable topics ahead, and I'm going to be asking for volunteers. So I will repeat back for the folks listening what you volunteer in the course of questions. But I just wanted us to keep a few things in mind. So one, we're all friends here and or siblings in the Lord Jesus. So let's assume that as a group, we can handle this conversation and that we can do it with respect and dignity and all these things, I have no doubt that you all are capable of this. Because I think a lot of times, as this other points get to, a lot of times we assume that mistakes in these conversations around race and ethnicity and things like that are not permissible, right? That you shouldn't say anything lest you say the wrong thing. But I don't think that's a very helpful way to think about all of this, because how else will people learn what is helpful unless they're given opportunity to try? So I think from the start, I think we reframe to think about this conversation as the way you would learn a language, right? So if you're learning Spanish or French or German, Hebrew, et cetera, you're gonna make a lot of mistakes up front. And that's okay, that's part of the game. Everyone expects that you're going to make mistakes, but the point of mistakes is to make fewer mistakes over time. So I think as long as we're willing to be in a position where we can say, I'm gonna ask this question, it might sound wrong, I'm happy to be corrected if it's offensive, these sorts of things. I think if we're willing to enter into the space with that sort of mentality, thinking about it as though we're learning a language, because in some ways it is, I think we'll all be in a pretty good space moving forward. So I just wanted to flag that for you all, that this is a space where you're welcome to ask questions, you're welcome to ask uncomfortable questions, things you've never asked before. And, you know, that is a really important part of what we're doing here. So part of it is the way I work as a teacher. I don't like to hear my own voice all the time. It's actually kind of irritating. but part of it is as well, I hope that you all get something out of this space by participation rather than just listening and taking notes or something like that. So does that sound good to everyone? Thumbs up? Okay, great. Let's jump right in. So we're gonna start with this picture here. This is from a New York Times article called "Why Do American Grocery Stores Still Have an Ethnic Aisle?" It's a really interesting read. I recommend it to you all if you haven't read it. So what can you all tell me about this aisle in particular? For those of you who are at home, the picture is of a shopping center, a grocery store aisle with a hanging sign, and one of the phrases on the sign says ethnic foods. So what is in the ethnic foods aisle? Let's just start there. What's there? Yes.
I was going to say, for me, I know I can go to that aisle and get specific Chinese spices, sauces, additives, maybe some vegetables. Also, the salsa will be there.
Right.
No,
absolutely. That's a really good point, though. Some things are not in the ethnic aisle that otherwise you might think should be. Okay, we'll hold on to that for a second. But for those of you who are at home, Chinese spices, sauces, these sorts of things, it's good. So, the good salsa, it's good to know. Anyone else? Other things? What? So stuff that's in the aisle. Goya. That's right. Yeah, you know, a reliable product from time to time. So foods that are generally affiliated with Latino groups, Latinx people, you know, Asian, right, Asian foods, foods from India, often in the ethnic foods aisle. Okay, good. So, a follow-up question, what about the rest of the store? I didn't catch your name. What was your name? Heath. I said that right, Heath, not Keith.
Keith,
okay, thank you. Keith pointed out something that's really interesting. So sometimes when you're in the store, there's salsa in the ethnic foods aisle, but also salsa elsewhere. What's going on here? What's the deal with the rest of the food? It's an open-ended question. Yeah. Okay.
And I actually really appreciate it because I like those foods and it's really
easy. No, I mean, this is what the article in the New York Times gets at, is that for a lot of people, the idea of switching their food away from the ethnic food aisle means that people wouldn't be able to find it anymore. And this is why, as the summary of the article, why people still hold on to this ethnic food aisle, because it's a way to designate food, people can know where to look for it, it's easy to locate, these sorts of things. But yeah, I think that's an interesting point, right? That the ethnic, and this is something the article talks about as well, that some people don't want their food to move out of the ethnic section because then it corresponds to some kind of mainstream understanding of food that loses its particularity. So that's really interesting what you said as well about like recently arrived immigrants. I think we'll hold that up in the air as well. There's some good stuff there. So you had your hand up, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just
Right. That's a very fascinating point. And one of the ones I was hoping somebody would say, which is great. So this is fascinating, right? Here on the sign, we have kosher food, and then separate from ethnic foods. Keith, yeah.
There's a whole Italian aisle.
Yeah. No, right. Absolutely. So the Italian aisle is marked pasta and sauce and things of that nature, and it's not ethnic. And then we have a whole separate section for kosher. So, yeah. No, right. I mean, it's just so it's whereas, yeah. So, ugh, so much there. We could spend the whole time talking about this. So one more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. French food, Italian food, these things have just kind of been woven into normal, let's say. So, final question about this particular section. How do these choices get made? I don't talk to anybody who owns a grocery store, so I'm not really sure. But let's just think out loud for a minute. How do you decide what, as some of you have raised, right, that certain foods are found inside and outside of the ethnic section despite corresponding very tidily to ethnic categories in some ways that we're familiar with. Who makes these choices?
Marketing people.
Okay. You had your hand up?
They might track the questions at the service desk.
Right.
Asking, right.
Asking for questions at the service desk, so kind of correlating the data to what people are looking for. Right.
And if you put things together, people are purchasing for a meal or a full recipe and not just one-off.
Right. So it's you're kind of guiding based on how much things you can sell. That makes a certain degree of sense. I mean, quite a bit of sense, but there's also more too. I think there we've kind of dug any other thoughts how these sorts of decisions are made? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Queso and salsa from Hares and Lay's American company. So those are the Americanized
right.
things that you can put in chips. If you go in the ethnic aisle, all of the salsas and things have Mexican sounding names.
Right, yeah. I mean, no, that's absolutely right. No, yeah. I mean,
so we culturally accommodate, or whatever that is.
Yeah. We've appropriated, right? Yes. Yeah, no, that's Eric's that said that. No, right. So these things have become mainstream eyes. Like, if you think about this, I think there's an interest. If any of you have Hulu, there's a wonderful series called Taste the Nation with Padma Lakshmi. She's this food presenter and model actress sort of person. But she goes around and eats all this really interesting food, and she stops in, I think she goes to somewhere in the Midwest. I should know this. It's a beer brewery. Help me out.
Milwaukee.
Great, that's actually it. She goes to Milwaukee and she tries a number of Germanish foods, hot dogs and things like that. And these all kind of sprung into being as a result of German immigrants prior to World War II. After the war, all of these, they tried to stifle the Germanness of their presence in their communities because they didn't want to be affiliated with the Nazis. So then all of these sausages and things become mainstream, like hot dogs kind of take on a life of their own outside of these communities. So it's really fascinating then if we're starting to think about what these sorts of decisions are based on, how do things get absorbed into our lives, so on and so forth. So that said, let's move on to a next set of questions, a little bit more personal. So questions being, what did you have for breakfast today? If you had breakfast, no pressure. And are there foods that are not for breakfast in your mind? And where did you learn that? So I'll start. So this morning I had eggs for breakfast. There are foods that are not for breakfast. I usually don't think of rice-related dishes as a breakfast food. Right. Yeah. No. I mean, that's absolutely right. So where did I learn this? I mean, it was just we never had rice at breakfast time growing up. Nobody ever said, "Oh, don't have rice with breakfast." It was just never a possibility. Right. It was nobody would have suggested in my household that, oh, here's some rice, you could make, you know, there are a lot of really lovely options for rice breakfasts, but not things that I would think about. Okay, so that's me. Anyone else? Things you had for breakfast? Keith.
For my French food fan, I had quiche.
Oh, great. Quiche is nice. That's a nice breakfast. But are there foods that are not for breakfast that you can think of?
Green vegetables.
Yeah, fascinating. But okay to have spinach in your quiche, right? Or in an omelet. Fascinating. Okay. Other things that people had for breakfast.
Cold pizza.
Cold pizza. Nice. Yeah. Oh, okay. So leftovers, shall we say? Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Go ahead.
I had toast, oatmeal, and coffee.
Toast, oatmeal, and coffee. Okay. Good. So there's a pretty wide range of things that we've all had for breakfast, and then so only a couple things that are not for breakfast: green vegetables, rice. But green vegetables acceptable in some circumstances. Anything else? Yeah.
Fish.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
I'm there with you. I mean, but if you're camping, I guess you could have trout if that was all. But I only know that from that that Parent Trap film. So. Yeah. Right. Okay. So we're getting into it. Right. These categories are fluid. Right. These categories of what corresponds to what we eat, how we find it, what we enjoy, what's acceptable, what's mainline, what's mainstream, what's not mainstream. These are all things that are in some ways cognitive, right? It's not about the substance of what's in the fish. It's not what kind of fish. It's that certain fish are breakfast fish and certain fish are not breakfast fish. And there's not really a way to figure out why that is. It is the way it is for people. So this gets us to kind of the main subject. So I want to make this argument based on what we've thought about, that ethnicity is about your mind. Ethnicity is a cognitive dimension from which you interpret the world. And in particular, how you categorize. So difference, otherness, belonging, these sorts of things are all a part of this way of seeing the world. So I'm making the argument that it's not, for example, it's not the corn that makes the corn flour for the tortillas ethnic, right? Because otherwise, you know, cream corn or corn on the cob scattered throughout, not ethnic sections of the grocery store. But then corn flour for tortillas is particularly ethnic, right? It's not the material itself, it's the way we think about it. So this is important to know, right? These ethnic things, ethnic ways of being, acting, thinking, these are not genetic realities, right? These are socialized. We learn them, we teach them, we reinforce them. And I think that it's really important to think about that, in particular around things like breakfast, right? Certain things are acceptable for breakfast, certain things are not. But we've never heard that, right? It's just kind of in the water. We wouldn't, you know, fish for breakfast. I'm right there with you. I wouldn't do that. Why though? But I would have a bagel with lox, right? So interesting that these things are also very flexible, as I said before, that there's no fixed, it's not all fish, it's just some fish in a way that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And so when we're talking about these things generally outside of food, this is also the case. Ethnic designations of people groups or certain types of music, say, these sorts of things are fluid and socialized. They don't fall out of the sky the way they come to us. And when we're talking about ethnicity, it's also important to distinguish this from race. So race is, yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Well, I want to push to that. There is no black aisle.
Mm.
And if you go to the ethnic aisle, you don't find black food.
Right, there's no soul food aisle, yeah. Oh, there is a section. Okay. Well, so I... Anyway, so all this is to say, sorry, what?
It's a brand of vegetable.
Okay, so this is all to say that even some of the ways things are located, you only know if you know, right? So that even further pushes that kind of cognitive level, that this is what we're thinking about. Now, what I was saying about race is that race is the product of a colonial project, right? When you invade other countries as a European in the 16th century, you create this category of white people at the top, black people at the bottom, and then you kind of distribute resources accordingly. This is not really what we're talking about with ethnicity, but I need to bring it up because I have to distinguish ethnicity from race. And there's always this kind of interplay. As ethnicity is a category started around the 40s, shortly after the World War II, it was started to kind of be this replacement term for race because people were reflecting on the Nazis and said, well, gosh, them talking about the Aryan race really went sideways, didn't it? We'd like to never do that again. Now, did that actually happen that way? Not quite, but it was the goal in some ways. So when we're talking about ethnicity, right, I'm talking about a cognitive construction that's different from categorizing human dignity based on skin color. At the same time that I'm making this distinction, we're operating in a world that's racialized and that we have to deal with race in almost every time we talk about differences between people. So as soon as we're kind of talking about the ethnic food aisle, then categories of race enter into our minds, and you're like, ah, yes, even if you don't notice that you're doing it, it's all there in the back of your mind. We're all socialized into this world. So it's important to name it right away, that this is not what we're talking about here, that I'm trying to make an argument for something different. So the main takeaway, if you will, from this talk is that everyone is an ethnic person, and everyone is ethnic, and we all think and act as ethnic people. So that brings it to why I think this is interesting. So this is myself and some kind of sloppy math equations. So we have the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, where my father's family is from, coupled with Davis, California, where my mother was born. And then as a result of these two communities, you have myself. So what this means is that I grew up in a household of twice the amount of ethnic data that some people have. And what that means is I had to make a lot of choices, right? And you start to notice, you know, when your dad's, Mexican heritage Catholic and your mom is Scottish heritage Presbyterian, you start to kind of, you know, you're just like, there's this weird tensions in the water. The Virgin Mary comes up and everyone, like, it's super tense. And you're like, I don't, you know, breakfast foods and these sorts of things. There are some things that we ate that not everyone else ate. Avocados were a big deal in my family. Anyway, so when I came to be, a lot of these questions were just kind of in the water. Well, why do we do this? Why don't we do that? Why is mom's family like this? Why is dad's family like that? And so on and so forth. So then the second equation is this multiplying one. So I'll kind of give you some of the terms up front. So this is myself. I'm Chicano, so which is to say I have Mexican heritage, but I don't self-identify as white. And there's a long story about why that's the case, and we could talk about it later during the questions if you'd like to know. But to save ourselves time, I'm just telling you about how I got to this perspective of doing research in the Hebrew Bible and ethnicity at the same time. So you've got me with very complex heritage thrown into Sunday school. I grew up in the Lutheran Church and in the ELCA. And in my experience, Sunday school teachers did not like questions. I was a very, so if any of you are Sunday school teachers, questions are nice. Children like to ask them. Please encourage them to ask more. As a result of Sunday school and being told to continue my art project 5 to 6 times instead of answering my questions about the Bible, kind of set myself on a path to embrace curiosity, by which I got several academic degrees and was ordained. And I'm going to be honest, part of that was that so nobody would ever tell me again, color your King David, don't ask any more questions. now I ask the questions, you know, so. So this all led me to some really big questions, right, about ethnicity and the Bible. So the questions that I had were, what does the Bible do in the lives of ancient people? How does it shape the way they view their world? Because I think a lot of times we just read it and assume that they're reading it like a history book. Ah, I now know about King David. Well, it's not quite enough, is it? Why would you keep reading it if it was just to know things? Textbooks don't necessarily survive in the books that I move with me periodically. You know, you leave the history textbook behind if it's not worth it to you to keep it. So then another question is, how do readers and interpreters of the Bible be honest about their own ethnic and racial social locations in the world? So as I was hinting at earlier, it's in the water. It's everything we do and see and think and eat is related to our social locations, to our family, to our heritage, to the language that we speak, to the place that we live. But when you look at a lot of biblical interpretation and biblical scholarship, this is not on the table. And the mainstream of biblical scholarship doesn't acknowledge this as an important question. Other people, some people sitting in the audience do, and that's really helpful. But this question still exists for me as an important part of what I do. What does it mean if we acknowledge that we have a place as readers before we start? Go ahead.
So this is seems to me to be a very American question.
Mm.
Because America is such a melting pot of immigrants.
Right.
That really creates the ethnicity in America. And I don't know if there are ethnic Americans. I'm sure there are.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Different background.
Yeah. Right. So that was about, you know, a million plus Syrian refugees really raised this question for Germany. And even, if, I mean, the question is, could be pushed even further. Again, let's separate it out from race, because North and South Germany, very different. If you've ever been to Bavaria, it's, you know, after the war, a lot of Nazis just went home. I mean, just, and I don't mean this to be like, I have friends in Germany, they're very nice people, that not every German is a Nazi, this is not what I'm saying. What I am saying, though, is that the North, that Berlin area, kind of this focal point of the 20th century, was not the same as the South. So even the result of more recent historical developments, I have a friend who's German and his family was in the East during the Iron Curtain Cold War time. And then after the war, after the Iron Curtain came down, Berlin Wall collapsed and these sorts of things, there's still a good deal of prejudice between East and West Germans that has kind of taken on an almost ethnic reality. So I hear your point, though. America, you know, the United States as a country, we have so many different immigrants from so many different places. But the question of social location, how we think, what influences the way we think, the what our language implies, most European countries had empires at one state or another. So I think these are the sorts of things that then kind of conglomerate immigrants that you know, some of the best food that you could get in the United Kingdom for quite some time was from India. You know, Indian and Chinese immigrants really were the food to get if you're going to go out to eat in London until quite recently. So anyway, I hope that addresses your question. I think you're onto something, and also that this is a problem and a question that we all have to face no matter where we live. And then my last question being, what does this all do for religious communities today? So, what does this mean for us in the church? So let's jump straight into the ethnicity in the Old Testament. In 586, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, as we all are familiar with, probably. And this resulted in basically the total loss of all markers of ethnic reality for ancient Israelites. So if you think about being taken thousands of miles from your home in a time where there's no phones or internet or anything, you're just lost. You have no temple to worship in. You have no food to eat that you're used to, you don't know where you are, and you're not sure how your culture and language will survive. So what do? It turns out you make a Torah, you make a Pentateuch. You start to use these texts as a way to create the things that you have lost. So in this sense, I want to argue that the Torah is about shaping Israelite ethnicity in history, right? This is we'll get to later what this does for us. But it's serving as a replacement of sorts. It's a stand-in for everything else that you've lost. These stories and legal materials become the way you know who you are in a place where you've lost so much else. So this brings us to Deuteronomy, which reinterprets the rest of the Torah and the Pentateuch. So it's at least at the last level of Deuteronomy when it's edited, it's kind of looking back and saying, what do we think about all of these things that are in the rest of this big scroll? And then it ends, interestingly, the story on the edge of the Promised Land. So the Israelites do not get into the Promised Land in the course of the Torah, the Pentateuch. It's read every year, and they're never in the land, right? Joshua is not a huge part of Jewish liturgy, so it's there, but it's not really read very often. And so it's really important then to ask, okay, well, we know that people went back, but then there's also this tension of the Torah, the most important part of Judaism in some senses, does not include the fact that people actually were back. It hints at it, but it's never explicitly said. So we've got this text that's trying to balance this diasporic reality of Judaism. There were people in Babylon who never returned. Most people, for instance, didn't go back to Jerusalem when the Persian king made it possible. So then we've got this strange text trying to balance a lot of things, holding a lot of things up in the air. And it's doing it through Moses' words. So basically all of Deuteronomy is Moses' discourse. So he starts talking at the end, and then he dies, and it's narrated that he's dead. So you've got Moses, and you've got the narrator, and that's basically about it. Even the words of God in Deuteronomy are through the voice of Moses. So Moses is telling the story, and you have this narrator saying things like, especially when Moses dies, they're like, he was the best person ever. Moses is not going to write that about himself, right? So we need to acknowledge up front that there's at least various authors happening here. And then that one of the things that this is doing, the Book of Deuteronomy is doing, is shaping this post-exilic reality for the people who returned. They needed to know what it meant to live back in this land that they had lost and then we're back in. So what does it mean for them to live alongside their neighbors? And this brings us to the second chapter of Deuteronomy. For interest of time, in my head I thought there was going to be more time. There's not going to be as much time. So I'm going to read, and I'll point out a couple of things along the way. So this is starting talking about the nation of Edom in Deuteronomy chapter 2. And so the Israelites have just failed dramatically to follow the commands of God, and so they're kind of sent back into the wilderness. And at this point, the text picks up. Then we turned back and set out toward the wilderness along the route to the Red Sea, as the Lord had directed me. Again, Moses talking here. For a long time, we made our way around the hill country of Seir. Then the Lord said to me, "You have made your way around this hill country long enough. Turn now north. Give the people these orders. You are about to pass through the territory of your relatives, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau," the emphasis in me, "the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. The Lord has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He's watched over your journey through this vast wilderness these 40 years. The Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked anything." So we went on past our relatives, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. Now, the thing that I want to point out here is that Esau is named, right? Where do we know Esau? We know Esau from Genesis. Jacob and Esau, these are the kind of the stories. But the way Esau is presented here is quite positive. If you notice that they're called your relatives, the descendants of Esau, not these people who we have this awkward relationship with. If you read most of the Jacob cycle from 25 to say 36 or so, there's a lot of tension in the book of Genesis between Jacob and Esau. We get none of that here. There's none of that tension here. What we do get is that based on, I'm going to make the argument that based on chapter 36 in Genesis, Yahweh is giving Esau land permanently that Israel has no right to. So that Israel and Edom, the children, the descendants of Esau, are on an equal playing field. So for the author, the way this is all working out is that you have people who have moved back from Babylon into Jerusalem, and Edom is still a nation at that point. And the way this community is being narrated to them is as family. You know, the author is essentially saying, you remember the story of Esau and Jacob in Genesis chapter 36, a very positive narrative. You remember that story, so treat them accordingly. They'll be afraid of you, they'll sell you food and water, and they're your relatives. And also, as Yahweh notes, I have not given you any of their land. All of their stuff is their stuff, and you have your own stuff. And even to the extent where you get this kind of this follow-up, where God has blessed you in all the works of your hands, essentially, you don't have to worry about not having their stuff. You have your own stuff. This is what you would say to kids who are fighting over toys, right? Yes, I know your brother has a very nice bear. You have your own bear. You don't need his bear. You have your bear. This is the sort of thing you get. I mean, this is brothers being arbitrated by their parent, in a sense. It's really interesting. So then, let's skip forward to Moab, another neighbor. So, and in similar, you kind of go, you're going around the Dead Sea, so you go through Edom and up in the first community you get to is Moab before you cross the Jordan. So Moab is here, and basically I'll just summarize. We turned from the Arba Road, which comes up from Elath and Ezion Geber, and traveled along the desert road to Moab. The Lord then said to me, "Do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession." And then there's this interesting aside. The Emites used to live here, a people tall, strong, and numerous, tall as the Anakites. Like the Anakites, they too were considered some Rephites, but the Moabites called them Emites. Horites used to live in Seir, but the descendants of Esau drove them out. They destroyed the Horites from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did in the land that the Lord gave them as their possession. Okay, that's a lot. There's a lot of people names. It's confusing. What I want you to focus on is this: the end here. We've got the descendants of Esau and the Horites, who they destroyed just as Israel did in the land the Lord gave them. So we have this parity, again, between Esau, the children of the children of Esau, Edom, and Israel. Moab, weirdly, is not narrated that this battle takes place just like Israel. They're just, they have this land that they're given as descendants of Lot. Note that Lot did not get a promise, unlike Esau. Esau got a promise, Lot did not. Now, there's a lot of reasons why we could assume this is the case, but if we're kind of going back to Genesis and we read Genesis chapter 19, Lot is not a great biblical figure. Lot is kind of set up in Genesis as the counterpoint to Abraham. Abraham was this very hospitable, faithful man who's oriented towards, you know, people come to his house to eat and he sprints around and brings them water and food and all these things. And at a certain point in, I think, Genesis 13, Lot and Abraham are kind of looking at the land, and Abraham says, what part of the land do you want? And Lot takes the best part for his flocks and leaves the rest to Abraham. There's an implicit judgment there in the text. In terms of hospitality, the way the Middle East still works today, doing that sort of thing is terribly rude. You would say to the person who's older than you, which do you prefer, older relative? But Lot doesn't do that. So there's kind of a setup about Lot being less important. So we've got, on the one hand, Esau, and then we have Lot, kind of as determining what corresponds to these communities around Israel. So what I think is important for Israel ethnicity here is that these traditions that we find in Genesis of Israel's ancestors are the key point to what defines belonging for Israel, right? That you have this focus on Abraham as the metric of what constitutes us in some ways. Note that Esau and the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, are family, they're relatives. Meanwhile, Moab is just descendants of Lot. They're like very distant relatives who you don't really like and you're kind of stuck with and you have to talk to at Thanksgiving periodically. But they're not hostile, but they're not friendly. So these are some things to keep in mind, that the Bible is self-referencing to create the designations that Deuteronomy wants to push. And that these sorts of things are being reinforced in communal reading. So you're reading it in the synagogue. So the going to religious service in some way is the same as reinforcing your ethnicity as an Israelite, which could be the set of us today, interestingly enough. And also here, the biblical narrative, these little pieces of narrative, are meant to shape worldview and lived actions. You don't just get information about the Moabites and the Edomites and say, ah, that's nice to know. You get it to know that there's still people you can interact with. Moab is not hostile to you. Edom is not hostile to you. Edom is, in fact, quite friendly. Moab is not hostile. They'll sell you stuff, but they're not going to be your best friends. These are the sorts of points that the text is trying to create, such that the Israelites returning from exile are able to know what it looks like to live in the land. So this brings me to a couple points that I think are, in a summary, we're right at question time, so I'm going to push through real quick. So I think all of this kind of leads us to a sense of awareness, right? That when we're reading the Bible, as of all the other things that we do, we approach it from an ethnic somewhere. There's no view from nowhere, shall we say. Even think about Presbyterians, right? Who are the theologians that we associate with the Presbyterian tradition? Calvin, Bart, Knox, handful of others who I can't think of off the top of my head. But these people are all European men who have been dead for quite some time. Now, this is not to say that all of their thoughts are bad or anything like that, but all of their thoughts are necessarily limited. So then when we're asking about these kind of roots that we bring to every space, what are the parts that are constructive? And what are the parts that perhaps are better left to the side? As is the case with many theologians through time, I think, aside from Bart, certain people's thoughts on Jews ought to be left outside the church and on the dumpster heap of history. Theologians are not always winning them on that issue. So this then brings me to the next point, is responsibility, right? Ethnicity doesn't fall out of the sky. We make it. We do it. We reinforce it. We teach it, whether we know it or not. So then the question about us in this space is, who is here and who is not here? And why is that the case? Are we okay with that? And how are we actively constructing belonging and otherness in our communities? I think these are things that we desperately need as church people to think about, because these issues are pressing on us every day in American society, and practically every news article, these are questions that we're being asked in one way or another. And then overall, I think that Israel scriptures help us reframe how to think about our own ethnic location. So if we zoom back, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and the New Testament are primarily Jewish. right? These are all, almost every text that you touch in your Bible was written by, was finally edited by a Jewish person with the intent to be read in communities that included Jews. So even Paul's letters read in the New Testament include, most of them, are directed towards communities that are both Jewish and Gentile, this odd mixed group. And so, you know, as non-Jewish Christians, if we take ourselves quite seriously and honestly in front of the Bible, we realize that we're othered as we're reading these texts. We are historically distant by thousands of years from the audience these texts have in mind. We're ethnically different. We're not Jewish. And we're religiously different. I mean, even early Gentile Christian communities would have no idea what we're doing. I mean, some of it, I think communion they might understand, but they'd think it sounded very strange. And so I think what this leads us to is a position of humility in front of the text, that we get to have these texts because Jews in antiquity decided that Gentiles could share in their traditions. So a certain Jewish Messiah and a certain series of Jewish apostles made the decision that people like us could belong to this community that got to use these texts. And so I think then, as Christian people living in this very multi-ethnic world, it's incumbent upon us to understand our own contexts, but then to ask, how do we mimic this posture of hospitality that was showed to our ancestors thousands of years ago? How do we open ourselves to other people and risk our own customs, traditions, foods, ways of thinking and speaking? How do we open ourselves such that we risk this changing, but get so much more in return? That's all I've got. Questions? Sorry, no need for applause. But we are on for, we got about 8 minutes by my clock. So I'd be pleased for your thoughts. Yeah, Keith. Yeah.
Is the created answer to questions that all humans ask.
Sure.
Where did I come from and where am I going? Right? That's ethnicity.
I mean,
you are from here, your parents were from here, your grandparents were from here. This is who you are, right? That's a change.
Well, so I think, go ahead.
To make your own ethnicity who you are.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm going to try to summarize for the people at home. So the question being, ethnicity being kind of from your perspective, Keith, the ethnicity is a way of understanding where you come from and how you think about the world. Am I getting that right? And then what we ought to be doing then is to understand where we are and then be welcoming where other people are. Is that, am I summarizing well?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, great. No, I think you're right on. I think it's important, like I was saying, all of this is constructed, right? So the hierarchy that we create in our minds is just because we're used to doing a thing, right? Like when I got married, my wife and I had very different ideas of when you ate breakfast. Yeah. Her family has a long kind of progressive breakfast through the morning, and I'm a large, hungry man, and I'm just like, I want the food now. And I was cooking, so I would be like, okay, we've got the eggs, and she's like, I'm not hungry. I'm like, So anyway, all this is to say, it took me some time to realize neither of us were right about breakfast. That doesn't make any sense. But you have different needs being married, et cetera. But all this is to say, then you have to be open to the fact that everyone's way of doing stuff is somewhat arbitrary and crafted and created. None of it fell out of the sky. And so you're right. This sense of understanding where we come from, who our people are, what we eat and do, is, if we think about it as custom, well, I'm used to doing fill in the blank. Not my people do this, and it's the only way I've ever done this, and I won't change. You know, that's not a helpful posture as a Christian person, right? So, anyway, yeah, I think that's a great point, Keith. Others, yes.
I had a thought as you were talking about Torah and Pentateuch, mm-hmm, coming out of the captivity.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that those books came out of an ethnicity of conquered people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Brought here against their will. But many of the ethnic groups in the U.S. came here of their own will.
A wonderful question. So the question being that many of the texts that we have in the Bible, I would argue all of them are the result of oppressed, conquered peoples, and then not all of the readers of said texts are oppressed, conquered peoples, and so what does that do when we're having this discussion? I think it creates an important space for honesty. I'm just gonna talk about the church because I don't know what it does for everyone. I think it gives us an important space for honesty that we are not, again, that historical distance that I mentioned, we are not the audience that the text has in mind in general. We are doing quite well. We don't have the boot of an empire on the back of our necks. What I think that costs us in a certain sense is the willingness to say, we have privilege, where does it come from? What parts of it should we divest ourselves of and how? So when we are in the United States, a country with a checkered at best history of foreign involvements, I think it's incumbent upon us to ask those questions. So what do we do with our privilege and our American imperial privilege as readers of the Bible? I don't necessarily have an answer for that for everyone, but I do think it matters that that question is asked, that the Bible is oppressed people's literature, and if we're not oppressed people, what does that mean? I mean, all that I have is to essentially echo your question. I think it's really good and it's really important, but I think at a very basic level, it involves kind of taking some of what we've been given and giving it back to people who it was taken from. You know, whether that's resources or land or fill in the blank, I think that's, you don't keep stolen things for thousands of years. Although you could, if you're the British Empire, you keep a lot of things that you took and put in a museum. But yeah, other questions? Yes. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry, you were first and then.
So what question do we need to bring to biblical text?
Right. What question do we need to bring to the biblical text because we are not a part of the community that it was directed towards? I think on the one hand, there needs to be the assumption that this text is talking past me, right? That it's directed towards another community who's meant to hear it. So on the one hand, we need to be asking, what is this text saying? What are the words on the page saying? Are there things that make sense there that don't make sense there? What am I missing? And then what is it that I need to learn to understand the parts that don't make sense, right? And a very real awareness that some of the things you take for granted as you go through the Old Testament Hebrew Bible may not correspond to what's actually happening, right? That when we talk about, there are a lot of different portrayals of God, for example. So does God change God's mind? Some places yes, some places no. So there's a way of thinking about God that is not the same as ours there. We want a constant sort of portrayal of God in the Hebrew Bible. You want as many as you can stack on that are a part of the traditions that belong to your community. So yeah, I think saying to yourself, what is this saying? How much can I understand? And what do I need to know for the parts that I don't understand? I mean, it puts you in this position of responsibility before the text, right? That you have to assume that you don't know everything about what it's talking about as you open it. And I think that's a good place to be, as far as I'm concerned. Does that help?
Yeah.
Great. And you had a question.
I guess as I look back at the Old Testament and the New Testament in particular, it's very clear, say with Peter's vision, that the Christian church in its essence is an ethnic community. And yet, historically,
right.
The Christian church has seen itself and it's been trying to exclude others.
Yeah.
I do not see the Christian church in the United States, maybe some parts of it,
right,
speaking very strongly to the immigrant issues.
Yeah.
And the ethnicity issues.
Yes.
And it's certainly historically, I mean, the church in the South.
Yeah.
Did a horrible job in the North too.
Right.
Maybe Nassau Presbyterian.
Well, I mean,
so
just
how do we align that with Christianity, and do we what
Well, I think, again, first of all, great question. So the church, so the question being, the church is started as this kind of multi-ethnic community, this open doors in a lot of ways to as many people as possible, right? And then over time became hostile towards others, shall we say, who weren't a part of the faith. Is that fair?
Who weren't part of our
yes.
individual interpretation.
Right. People who weren't a part of our own individual interpretation of our traditions. Yeah, I mean, you've put the nail on the head, right? You hit it right on the head. I think the posture that Christian communities have taken over the years is fundamentally unchristian, right? That we are a part of this tradition that started with Pentecost, where the Holy Spirit fell on these random people who weren't supposed to be a part of the team, right? It fell on these, the story of Pentecost starts in Jerusalem, and the Holy Spirit falls on all these diverse Jewish folks who are gathered. And then starts to fall on Gentiles. These people who are not supposed to be included are suddenly talking about the Messiah of Israel. And you really, I mean, this is Eric's work in some ways much more than mine. Well, in a lot of ways much more than mine. But then you get these people who are suddenly not supposed to be a part of the team who are talking about stuff on the team. And so, these ancient Jewish folks had to make the decision, what do we do? And their decision was, I guess, include them. So then, that should be the posture we have now, right? I think your question about the oppressed people's literature versus where we're at is an important point. What do we do to try and adopt the sort of posture one has when one is not owning an empire, right? I think that's the question. That's the way we push, is to say, what if what's good for us as Christians is bad for us as Americans? And then what do we do from that point, right? Like, what if what's good for us as Christians means that we have an incredibly hospitable situation at the southern border? That then puts us in a position where we have to navigate our own national identity in particular ways that really are going to run against the grain for most people who you might encounter on the street. So I think it's a great question. Yeah, I see Marshall signaling that we're almost out. So
sadly, we are out of time.
Oh, okay, great.
We are out of time.
I'm around. I can stick around for about 10 minutes or so.
Thank you, Reverend Chauncey, for that wonderful presentation. There's so much to talk about and so much more to learn about this important topic. So we're just going to have you back again another time.
I'd be pleased.
That'd be great. thank you, everyone, for coming today. We are so happy to have you here this morning and to have this great discussion. So with that, we wish you a good day, and thank you again, Reverend Chauncey.
Yeah, thank you so much.